Thank you for inviting me to give a talk here. The subject of today's talk will be a recent paper. Here's the title that I wrote in collaboration with Harald Dieter and Harald Nieder, who are two postdocs in Tel Aviv. Yaron Oss from Tel Aviv University and Christian Rammelsberger from USC, LA. And well, what I will be talking about is the calculation of effective superpotentials in n equal 1 supersymmetric gauge theories using the general chiral ring structure of n equal 1 supersymmetric gauge theories and the Konishi anomalies. And this should be seen in some way complementary to the proposal of last June by Dyckgraf and Wafer how to calculate effective superpotentials by some very simple matrix models. And the approach we will using was essentially pioneered by Cacciazzo, Douglas, Seiberg, and Witten, who for a particular model showed that this approach reproduces exactly the loop equations that solve the matrix model, but they could derive it purely from gauge theory considerations. And today we will take the approach that we essentially forget about the matrix model completely and use just the Konishi anomaly and the chiral ring structure as a very efficient and quick tool to get all kind of non-perturbative data, in particular the effective superpotential and also the number of condensates that appear in these theories. And once we have, okay, the models we will consider in some detail also include theories that otherwise would be probably very hard to study in matrix models. We will, for example, study theories with some exotic gauge groups like G2 or theories with chiral matter, which have either exhibit no dynamical Susi breaking, and we can also treat cases where dynamical Susi breaking occurs. So the outline of the talk is following. I will start with a detailed discussion of the general strategy. Tell you quite a bit about the chiral ring and certain relations that reduce the number of independent objects in this chiral ring. Then explain a little about the Konishi anomalies, which essentially give us a set of ordered entities, which at the end will allow us to solve for the effective superpotential. In this case, we will calculate it as a function of the global superfield S and the couplings GL that appear in the tree-level superpotential. And we will do this in a lot of detail for the example of superQCD with one matter multiplied in the fundamental and one in the antifundamental, also discuss the vacuum structure. And then as time permits, I will discuss some other examples like G2 gauge group or chiral models with and without supersymmetry breaking, and then finally I will comment on the validity of this Konishi anomaly approach, or will tell you a little bit where certain assumptions break down. And so any n equal 1 supersymmetric gauge theory has a very interesting object, which we call the chiral ring. And its main players are, of course, chiral operators, which are just defined as being operators that are annihilated by half of the supercharges. So Q bar alpha dot of O should vanish. And each chiral operator also appears as the lowest component of a chiral superfield, phi, which if we have as super space formulation would be written like this. And the constraint on this chiral superfield, of course, is that V bar of alpha dot on phi vanishes. And this then schematically implies that for the chiral operator is annihilated by Q bar, but by acting with all other Qs, I generate the rest of the members of the multiplet. And so we should think of this also as the primary operator in this superfield. And there's a one-to-one correspondence between chiral superfields and chiral operators. So for certain relations we will later derive, you can either derive them in terms of components or in terms of superspace identities. Another important thing is that we can define something like Q-bar exact operators just by using the fact that in a supersymmetric vacuum, any Q-bar of some other operator will vanish. So having these two ingredients, we can now define the chiral ring as a cohomology, as the Q-bar cohomology on operators. And of course, this is in one-to-one correspondence with the D-bar cohomology of chiral superfields. So we can use this exchangeably, and later on we will actually not sometimes be sloppy with distinguishing the chiral superfield or the chiral operator. Finally, to get a ring structure, we also need a multiplication, and field theory this is given by considering OPEs. And there's one important fact about chiral operators that is important here, is that space-time derivatives of a chiral operator are Q-bar exact, so they are trivial in the chiral ring. And this immediately implies that correlators of chiral operators are actually constant, or in particular, they're also non-singular, position independent. And furthermore, we can now use cluster decomposition by separating these operators far away to show that such correlators actually factorize into simple C products of Fs of these operators. Now the next step we want to build the complete set of chiral operators, and in our case we have only two important multiplets to consider. In gauge theories we have either chiral metamultiplets in some representation R, and of course the super field strength, which has lowest component, the Cluino field lambda alpha. Now, of course, we can take all these fields and make all possible index contractions to construct other chiral operators, but we are particularly interested in gauge invariant operators for a number of reasons. First of all, these are really the building blocks of defective superpotential. They are the good variables to parameterize the vacuum of the theory. They also appear in condensates. And of course, most of the theories we discuss are confining, so anyway, they're the only good objects are gauge invariant operators. And one important example of that is the global superfield, which is just a bilinear object in the superfield strength field, and its lowest component, the Gaugino bilinear, that we will call S. In general, like this, we will be able to construct a large number of gauge invariant operators, but they're not all independent, of course, so we now have to discuss the chiral ring relations that reduce the number of independent operators. And we, as I mentioned before, we concentrate on the gauge invariant ones. So there are a number of elementary relations that can either be derived, as I mentioned, component language or by using some super space identities. And one important relation is that the Cluino in a given representation acting on some meta field phi in representation R is trivial in the chiral ring. for a field and adjoint representation, this action is just a commutator. So this means that commutator of these two fields vanishes. This means that in any contractions of operators, we can, for example, move all the lambdas to the left. And in particular, if we have two Gluinos, we find that relation, that the anti-commutator of two Gluinos is trivial in the chiral ring. And on the other hand, in the fundamental representation, we just find a linear relation, just the product of the Gluino times the field itself is trivial in the chiral ring. So, for example, in a UN theory with an adjoint chiral superfield, the set of chiral operators restricted by these previous relations takes the following form. There's just trace phi to the n operators with one superfield strength and another set series of operators where they appear at least at most quadratically. Any high of power of W's would be trivial in the chiral ring. So in single trace operators, the Gluino can only appear quadratically. But there are further restrictions on the chiral ring, and they come in two classes. One class is kinematical relations, the other ones are dynamical. The kinematic ones are usually due to group theory or Fermi statistics. For example, if you again look at the UN theory, where phi is in the adjoint, then only operators trace phi to the n with n smaller than the rank of the gauge group are really independent. All others can be represented as polynomials of the lower operators. And for the Gluino bilinear, we see just by Fermi statistics that lambda has two indices, one Fermi index alpha, so that this gives a factor of two, and the group index, so that at most you can take two times the dimension of G2 together, so this power is too high and has to give a zero simply by Fermi statistics. And in fact, one can show a more stringent relation, and that was shown by Gacciazzo, Douglas Seibert, and Witten himself for any classical gauge group that S to the dual Coxeter number is zero in the chiral ring. And this is, however, only true in the classical theory. In the quantum theory, there can appear here and here quantum corrections due to instantons. On the other hand, the dynamical relations are a consequence of the equations of motion, which schematically take the following form. This comes from the F term in this chiral, and this piece comes from the D term of the action and can be neglected in the chiral ring. And since we're only interested in relations for gauge invariant operators, we can take this contracted with some other chiral operator in this same representation, and we get the following relation, which again will have quantum corrections. And I mentioned here two examples. First, again, the example of UN with an adjoint field phi. In that case, we can have first the derivative of the three-level superpotential times arbitrary powers of phi are vanishing. And the second example that we will study in some more detail later is super QCD with one flavor in the fundamental and one in the antifundamental. In that case, already the each invariant chiral ring is much smaller than in the other case. We only get two operators, the Greenough bilinear and the meson field. And the reason that this set here is much smaller is that the chiral ring relation here is just linear. And a priori, we could have taken Q twiddle and squeeze in powers of W alpha, but due to this relation, they actually vanish. So we have only this small number of independent operators. And for super QCD, then, and now specializing on this, on the following three-level superpotential, which contains a mass term and a quartic interaction. This dynamical relation implies the following relation for the meson. Now again, these are only classical relations and are in general corrected by quantum corrections. And for example, this relation is corrected in the following way due to the Konishi anomaly. And it turns out that there's a three-level term plus an important one-loop term, which turns out to be linear and the Greenough bilinear. And for the examples we're discussing today, this structure of Konishi anomaly being three-level plus one-loop is exact. So this will allow us to solve the effective superpotentials there exactly. But in general, this must not be true. There could, in principle, be incident corrections. And I will discuss this at the end of my talk. Originally, Konishi derived this Konishi anomaly as the anomalous divergence of the following Noether current, which is associated with the transformation of the chiral superfield to some other chiral superfield. This can be either the same field or some product of fields. The only important thing is that this chiral superfield here is in the same representation as this guy here. And it takes the following form. Here the divergence is this three-level term plus this one-loop term, where we have here two gluinos contracted with gauge indices. And if we now take a vacuum expectation value of this object in a supersymmetric vacuum, this term goes away, and we find this Ward identity, which at the end of the day will allow us to express all vacuum expectation values of metafields in terms of the Gluinough superfield. So for the super QCD example, you can play this through in detail. Here I wrote down again the Konishi relation with the one-loop term. For our three-level potential, which had only quadratic term and a quartic term, we find this relation. So here we have the VEF of the meson squared. Then by cluster decomposition, we can write this actually, this factorizes as the square of the VEF of the meson. And we find a simple quadratic equation for the VEF of the meson in as a function of the couplings and the Greenough superfield. So this relation, again, to stress, this is only true in a supersymmetric vacuum. So we have to make sure that our theory actually has supersymmetric vacuum to be able to use this approach. And in theories where we don't have supersymmetric vacuum, which will appear later on, the approach we will take is we will deform the theory further by adding terms to the three-level superpotential to guarantee the existence of a supersymmetric vacuum, then calculate in a supersymmetric vacuum, and then study the theory by turning off this deformation again. So the final step in actually calculating effective superpotential is to know that even a three-level superpotential of the following form, this following linear form, some coupling times the Gauge invariant operator, one knows that there's the following gradient equation for the effective superpotential, namely the derivative of the effective superpotential with respect to the coupling gives you the VEF of the given operator. And this allows us to, after integrating this equation, to find the effective superpotential as a function of S and GI, but only up to the integration constant, of course, which is purely a function of S and lambda QCD. And this we will later fix by going to appropriate corners in the parameter space where we can basically decouple the matter fields in weak coupling so that at lower energies we have pure glue, so that the only input we really put in is to assume that pure glue at low energies is described by Veneziano-Yankelevich. If you assume that, then we can, with this procedure, uniquely calculate this effective superpotential. Again, going to a prime example of super QCD. We already had calculated the expectation values of the meson and the meson square as these square root expressions. And that's now the first derivative of W effective with respect to M. Integrating that gives you this expression, which once you expand the square root gives you an infinite power in the global superfield, but also this undetermined constant, undetermined function C of S. And here, drew this schematically, how we now can fix this C of S. We assume now that we expand around the classical vacuum where the meson VEF is zero. In that case, in that vacuum, the quarks have both mass of the order M. We can now make this mass large so that we can integrate these quarks out in a regime where the gauge theory is still a weak coupling. So then if we go to lower energies, we can essentially forget about the quarks. We have just pure gauge dynamics. And then the deep infrared, this should be described by Veneziano-Yankelevich. And in the intermediate regime, we will have the usual one-loop term for this effective potential. And this means that the deep infrared for this SCN theory, we want to replace this one-loop term by the following Veneziano-Yankelevich term, where lambda twiddle is the confinement scale. So that's the scale of the theory after integrating out the quarks. And the rest is just making sure that all terms linear in S of the part that we got already by integration of this gradient equation to match it appropriately, that the linear term is only given by that expression. So we have to add some additional correction terms. But the full end result is that. So just Veneziano-Yankelevich term plus the other term, which is at least quadratic in S and contains an infinite power in the global superfield S. mentioned before, this lambda 12 was the confinement scale of the pure super young males theory, and this is related of is related to the lambda QCD of the full theory by the usual matching condition. You can also look at the second classical vacuum, where the measure actually obtains a VEF. This, in our expression, corresponds to the minus sign branch. Remember, we had two branches because of the square root solution. And if you now concentrate on the Veneziano-Yankelevich term, we get the following term. We have NC shifted down by 1, and the different scale shows up here in the log term. And this is, as expected, in that vacuum, the gauge group is Higgs from SUNC to SUNC minus 1. So we expect only this NC minus 1 term here. And also the scale that appears here is the one that you expect from Higgsing some of the gauge bosons. And the relation is given here. And the relation, this term shows up because the mass of the W bosons that get Higgs are the square root of that expression. So that works as expected. This also tells you that in this branch you have now NC minus 1 vacua. So in total you have 2NC minus 1 vacua for this theory. And now with this full superpotential attend, we can also discuss a little the vacuum structure, this theory. We have to look for critical points of defective superpotential, and this can be compactly written in some algebraic equation. And in this language, we can think of the global, well, the expectation value of S triddle as a function of this parameter C, which is just a combination of scales lambda and M, and is actually living on 2NC minus 1 sheets corresponding to the 2NC minus 1 back here. And for certain values of C, some of these branches will collide or interchange. And that's a quite interesting story by itself. So I do here, for example, the story for the SU5 theory. And if we go to small c, this actually corresponds to go to some semi-classical weakly coupled regime, where we can really distinguish these two branches. The one branch where the theory is unHiggsed, then we have SU5. And then in this case, the values of S arrange on one circle with 5 values for S, and a smaller circle with 4 values. And this corresponds to the Higgs branch, where the gauge theory is reduced from SU5 to SU4. And if we now take a monotomy in the parameter space, meaning we take a small loop around C equals 0, we see that in that case, the 4 Higgs vacua are rotated into each other, but the other ones stay where they are. More interesting is if we go to certain branch points where two branches meet. In that case, what happens is that one vacuum from the Higgs branch and one from the unHiggs branch getting interchanged. And this tells us that in the full quantum theory, we cannot really distinguish the Higgs and the unHiggs branches. There's no meaningful distinction. And finally, if we go to very large values of C, then all vacua democratically distribute themselves on one large circle, and the monotomy rotation just exchanges them cyclically. Still any questions so far? And I'm going on to study other examples. First one, G2 theory with three flavors. This is just one example to show that we can also study theories with exotic gauge groups. This particular theory has both a meson field and a baryon field because G2 has this 3-index invariant, and the chiral ring contains yet another field, as usual, the Gitchino bilinear. And we want to study this theory for this following three-level superpotential. We have this mass term here, quadratic interaction and the cubic interaction. And furthermore, to make life a bit easier, we choose the mass matrix to be diagonal and all masses to be equal, which reduces the SU3 flavor symmetry to an SO3 flavor symmetry. And if you look at the classical theory, we find that there are two branches. One of them, the VEFs of all fields are zero. G2 gauge group is unbroken, and all the fields, however, are massive. So at low energies, it's pure G2 blue, which has four vacua. As in the other branch, the fields obtain VEFs. The gauge group is reduced to SU2, and you get an additional two vacua. So then it's a total of six vacua, that theory. And in this case, we have to consider two kinds of transformations which are related to the Knish anomalies. First of all, the usual one, which is linear, the field Q. And we also need a generalized Knish transformation, which is bilinear in the quarks. So in this case, the one-loop Knish anomaly relations take the following form. That's corresponding to the first transformation. That's the usual Knish equation. And the second one is this one. It turns out that in this case, the S dependence drops out completely. We can again solve now for the vacuum expectation values of the operators in terms of the global superfield and the couplings. We find these expressions. And using the same method as before, integrating the gradient integration and fixing the Veneziano-Yankelevich in a good semi-classical limit, we find this expression for the complete effective superpotential. And again, there are two branches here designated by this alternating signs. And you can read off that in this case, you get from one branch, because of the factor of four here, again, four vacua. And in the other branch, we have that this term here contributes a 2s log s. Namely, if we expand for the minus branch here, this square root, the leading constant term cancels, and we get that the leading term of this expression is linear in s. So we get plus 2s log s, which shifts this factor here four down to 2. And we get another 2 vacua from that branch. So in total, get the 6 vacua as expected. And this expression also agrees with calculations that have been done purely in field theory using the method by Seiberg and Intrilligator. Another class of models we can study using this method are chiral models. And I will start with a model that does not exhibit supersymmetry breaking. It's an SU6 model with two antifundamental fields in the 6-bar, and one antisymmetric, the 15. This matter content is also implied by anomaly cancellations. And in this case, now the chiral ring is generated by these two operators. They're both cubic in the matter field. And there's, of course, also the Gacino bilinear. And we would like to study the theory with this three-level superpotential. Now, with this three-level superpotential, we have only one classical vacuum, where all vefs are zero. And the problem arises now that all the matter fields are massless, so we cannot use the method of before to match the Veneziani-Yankelevich term. So we cannot really cleanly separate the matter fields from the gauge dynamics. So in order to do that, we now deform this three-level superpotential further in order to have a region where all the matter is sixed away and pure glue remains in one of the branches of the theory. So I will tell you that on the next page. So this could be done in several ways by adding all kind of operators. We chose to add this term here. And there are now two branches, two classical vacuum. One again, the bad one, where the vefs are zero. Gauge symmetry is unbroken. But in the other vacuum, both operators get vefs. The gauge symmetry is broken to sp2. And 25 of the 27 matter fields, they just get eaten up in the Higgs effect. And the two remaining massive matter fields, they are actually singlets under the sp2. So they disappear from the gauge dynamics. So now we can again look at our Konishi relations. In this case, we'll take the following form. Standard procedure gives us the vefs for these operators. And we can again integrate squared integrations. And omitting further details, we find this expression for the effective superpotential. So we find now in particular term with a 5 in front of the S log S. And plus here denotes the unhigged branch with the full SU6 theory, and the minus branch is the SP2 theory.
Do you know it's valid for the plus sign? What was that the point? I mean, the derivation is only valid for the minus sign?
Now we assume here that analysity like allows you then to take over the result for all regions if you don't hit any points with phase transitions or additional massless fields.
Does that mean that these branches are continued connected by going around the non-trivial path?
Yeah.
Yes, they are.
For example, in the SQCD case, that also happened there.
So there's no invariant distinction between them. It's like the classical apparent distinction, is that?
Yeah. So here we see, particular for the Higgs branch again, this constant here gets shifted because of this term, again, brings that coefficient down here to 3, and that is consistent with the fact that there's an SP2 theory in the Higgs branch with dual coxeter number 3. And now we can again try to take the limit lambda to 0, which is only smooth for the unhigged branch, and in this case, we obtained this much simpler effective superpotential, which has also been obtained by these people. I mean, that model is also studied in that long review on supersymmetric theories. In particular, this theory has 5 vacua, as they also found there.
What you call them, the unhinged point is really five vacua in classical limit of regular length.
Yeah, because they have zero BEV in the classical theory, but of course if you look at the expressions for the BEVs in the quantum theory, there were these square roots. So if classical theory is for me setting S to zero, and then for the plus branch, these BEVs classically go to zero, but quantum mechanically they are not vanishing.
Then my paper, that's the old review that you're citing there?
Yes.
So they figured this out in some other way?
Well, for one, they also used Konishi relations there to relate condensates with expectation values of degree bilinear. And they also did this strong coupling instanton calculation, which doesn't always agree with other approaches. For example, for n equal 1 super animals, the value of the condensate differs using different methods. In particular, their approach would give the wrong number there. But, okay. Finally, I want to discuss a model which exhibits dynamically supersymmetry breaking. And the example we use is this Isawa Yanagida Intrilicator Thomas model. And I shortly reviewed here the results known for that. The gauge group is SPNC, the matter content is very specific. NF is NC plus 1. And there's also a gauge singlet operator, which is antisymmetric in the flavor indices. Mm-hmm. So the chiral ring in that case. Again, pretty small, you have a meson screen of bilinear. And they studied this model in the presence of this tree-level superpotential and found, again, using this method of Seiberg and Intrilicator, using symmetries and then doing a one instanton calculation to fix the coefficient, this term here, they find this answer. And if you extremize that, you find the following equations, which in general are not compatible, meaning that SUSY is broken in that case unless the parameters in this tree-level superpotential obey this relation. That's the case for the. And now I want to show you how this can be also, this relation in particular can be derived with our method. Because I maybe haven't mentioned it before, but we always need a supersymmetric vacuum to do our calculation because we use this Konishi relation. So we again have to do the trick of deforming this theory further in order to guarantee the existence of supersymmetric vacuum for any parameters, and then we can at the end turn off this deformation and see what's happening to the supersymmetric vacuum. So as in I'd expect in that case you see the particular runaway behavior of certain vacua, and if you fine-tune these parameters, some of the vacua actually survive. The term we turn on is very simple. It's just a mass term for this singlet field, which in the original model only appeared as something like a Lagrange multiplier. And in this case, again, you get two kind of classical vacua, basically. In one, where all the squawks are massless, and another vacuum in which all fields are massive. And in this case, you use the following transformations for Konishi relations. We get these Konishi relations, can again solve for the vacuum expectation values of all these fields, which in that case takes a bit more involved form. But what you see here is that if you now try for generic the values of the other parameters to send alpha to 0. To go to the other model, you see that most of these VAFs actually blow up. So that also shows you that generically you will have this runaway behavior. But leaving this parameter alpha finite for the time being, we can get this effective superpotential. And there are now not only two branches for this theory, because we have now a larger number of flavors. Each, once we diagonalize the Mason matrix, there's a number of eigenvalues, and they can all be in different branches. So if you set all of them into the same minus branch, then the VAFs take this form. And again, you see here this 1 over alpha showing up. So you, generically, you will have the runaway behavior unless you can turn this factor here to 0. And this is just this condition, which is equivalent to the one I showed you on the first transparency where I introduced this model. So in order to find a supersymmetric rack here in the alpha to 0 limit, we have to impose this condition on the three-level parameters and the coefficients in the three-level superpotential. And as I said, in that particular case where we impose this condition, then we find a supersymmetric vacuum where these VAFs go to 0 and the meson has this finite VAF. We could actually do the calculation also in the branch where all the eigenvalues are in the positive branch. Then if we send alpha to 0, we find the following effective superpotential. So most terms of the effective superpotential go away in that limit. It's a smooth limit. But we only end up with this superpotential, where S only appears as a Lagrange multiplier, imposing again this condition on the parameters. And I'm going to talk with some comments on the Kanishi anomaly we used here. We've seen that for those models, if I've shown you today, it's true that the Kanishi anomaly equation takes the form of three level plus one loop. This is an exact statement. But it turns out that in other theories with more general matter content, there in principle could be extra terms corresponding to instanton corrections. In particular, this will happen for models with these gauge groups and, for example, adjoint fields are met in the antisymmetric or symmetric. So whenever you have two index representations, potentially problems show up. And in particular, for the example of an SP gauge group with antisymmetric matter, Krauss and Shigemori found actually disagreement between field theory calculations and the matrix model approach, which is at the end equivalent to this Kanishi approach, as long as we assume three-level plus one-loop exactness. So in general, this means that we have to do some instanton corrections to find a calculation to find these corrections, and then try to solve the models from there. And it turns out that there's a rather simple criterion which tells you if the Kanishi equation is one loop exact. It's just expressed in terms of the indices of the edge joint and the indices of the matter representation. But you see that, for example, the UN with edge joint, or in particular also n equal 1 star, this relation is not obeyed. And you can have in principle corrections. And for this case, UN plus edge joint, the one loop equation took that form, and possible correction terms will be of that form. They're always, for that case, linear in the three-level superpotential couplings times some instanton-generated term, so lambda to the 2n times L, where L is the instanton number, and some trace phi to the m. So in general, these terms will be there, and I don't know of any good reasons why they shouldn't be there. This means that most of these models actually have to be reconsidered, most likely.
Does it affect the basic NUSRN model, the original?
I think so, because I don't know any honest field theory calculation we can compare this model to.
So in other words, we don't know if loop equations really generate superpotential?
No, they do, but we have to first determine these corrections. And these effects only these Kanishi relations, which correspond to transformations of phi into phi to the n, so they only appear in a certain order. At low order, they will not show up, or if you send n to infinity, then they won't show up. But for finite n at some degree, mm-hmm. these corrections will set in. And I guess for this SP model, exactly, we have to take into account these corrections to match the field theory calculation. But for the UN plus adjoint case, we actually always compare with the results that were obtained by softly breaking n equal 2. So there's probably not a good reason why this should be everything. But it also means that then the whole approach of the Kanishi anomaly will be very messy and maybe not a very useful tool to solve that. I mean, the beauty of that expression was that it gave you at the end the loop equations of the matrix model, which are very easy to solve. But once these corrections show up, it can become a big mess. Okay, that's all I have to say. I can show you in private. I have two transparencies. Basically, we use here U1R symmetry and the symmetry corresponding to the Konishi anomaly, which is also U1 symmetry, just sending phi to phi. And it's basically the same argument as was used by Seiberg to fix the form of defective superpotential by lifting all couplings to superfields, giving them certain charges under the symmetries, and then just write down what is allowed by the symmetries. And then you find that such terms could show up, and you also find relatively easily this condition. But this is very rough. If it's violated, you have to look in more detail if you really find solutions. But if you obey, then you know that it's just one loop exact.
Because any instant correction would have the wrong, would blow up, would be, if you go to zero, is that where that comes from?
I can show you quickly how we do it, but
you get inequalities basically because you say all the coefficients in the Kanishi anomaly should be positive. So all the power should be cosine.
All the power is of lambda.
Okay. Lambda should always show up like this,
right,
like a regular instanton. Right. We assume that there's no fractional instantons. Right. And all couplings should appear as positive powers.
Ah, good.
Because we want a smooth limit if you turn them off. So for example, if you go back to the n equal 2 theory here, they all go away. So n equal 2 is still correct. But you're assuming also these nice behaviors when you turn.
Yeah.